Back after a couple of weeks off for the holidays. Remember last time we finished chapter 12, which was a song of salvation.
Great.
Very, very positive, wasn't it? And very uplifting. Then you will say on that day, and of course that day daisy chains back to the day that God would lift up a standard, i.e. Jesus Christ, John 12:33, or I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men to me. He lift up a standard and start drawing people. And so we sing this song of salvation. Chapter 13 begins a brand new section. Your reading assignment for the next several weeks will be chapters 13 through 18. 13 through 18 will be the reading assignment. And it's going to deal with the impact of the Babylonian invasion, which kind of sounds strange because who were we talking about in chapter 8 and 9 and 10?
Serious.
Assyria was flooding the land in chapter 8. It was, remember, Ahab didn't trust Yahweh. He will not believe, he will not stand. He didn't trust Yahweh, and instead of waiting for Yahweh's salvation against the two smaller nations, Israel and Syria, he hired Assyria to come help him. Well, Assyria came and helped himself and came in like a flood, chapter 8, kind of like a flood. And then in chapter 10, we have the picture of Assyria being what in the hands of God? An
Next.
axe that would cut down the forest, okay? And so then we come into chapter 13 and he's talking about Babylon. Well, what's the relationship between Babylon and Assyria? Babylon overtook Assyria 100 years after Isaiah was. So Babylon wasn't even a nation at this time. And who overtook Babylon? You remember? The Medo-Persians. And the king that was responsible, his name was Cyrus. We'll see him mentioned by name in chapter 45. And he hadn't even been born yet. Like maybe 50 years before he, 150 years before he was born, God called him by name. And we're going to build that thought as we go through the book. But point I want to make here is that Assyria conquered the 10 northern tribes, took them into captivity. And then Babylon came and finished the job with the two southern tribes and took them into captivity. It's almost like they were two parts of the same operation by God. Okay. And so there's going to be some indistinction between the Assyrian invasion and the Babylonian occupation as we go through Isaiah. but we know that we're dealing with Babylon in verse thir chapter 13, verse 1. It says so. With the oracle regarding Babylon. The word oracle means burden. The burden God is placing upon Babylon through this prophecy. Okay, so let's read down through verse 5 together. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. That's, to me, that's kind of interesting that it wasn't something he heard. It was like a motion picture, something he saw. You've done the same thing if you ever dreamed at night. You've seen things, okay? Lift up a standard on a bare hill, raise your voice to them, wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones, I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, right? Like that of many people. A sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. Yahweh of hosts is mustering the army for battle. They are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons. Yahweh and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. So there's the prophecy, the burden of Babylon. Okay. Lift up a standard. What's a standard? Lift up a standard, verse 2. Look, what's a standard? Pardon? A signal. It's like, here's the rally point. Here's the rally point. Okay. So on a bare, raise your voice to them. What's that all about? Raise your voice to them. Hey guys, over here. He's calling them. And then wave the hand. Come on, guys. You get a picture here in verse 2 of God rallying somebody to come against Babylon. So he says in 3, I have commanded my consecrated. What consecrated ones is Yahweh commanding at this point? Hello, Candy. Verse 3, I have commanded my consecrated ones. What's a consecrated one? Consecrate. The whole stack, Candy, the whole stack. Pardon? Yep, yeah, basically, basic. Set aside, made special. Y'all should have received 4 sheets of paper. 4 sheets of paper. And so you've got the, could be 4.
Did you put one on the back side?
They're both printed. All of them are printed front and back.
You have 2 from the chapter. Only one handout. Is there another handout?
Yeah, I'll get it later.
Oh,
it must have hung up back there somehow. Okay, a consecrated one, set aside, set apart, made special, called to a special purpose. So he says, I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have even called my mighty warriors. Now, are you familiar with Hebrew parallelism? That's a special, that's their special form of poetry, where the second line in some way replicates the first line, either says the same thing in different words or says it in contrast. But the thought is the same. So here's my consecrated ones, my strong warriors. Okay. So we're calling the army. My proudly exulting ones. This is an army that's pretty confident. What's he calling them to? I've commanded, called to my anger. Okay. These guys are going to take care of my anger for me. So what's a tumult? Verse 4, a sound of a tumult. It's like the noise of a mighty crowd. It could be a party going on. It could be a riot taking place, but you just hear the rumble of this crowd.
Kind of like tumultuous.
Yeah, that's exactly the word. Tumultuous comes from the word tumult. Okay, you're on it, right? And so it's a noisy throng. Like that of many people, the sound of a uproar of the kingdoms of nations gathered together, Yahweh of hosts is mustering the army for battle. So in verse 2, we've got the beckoning. Here's the standard, here's the voice, here's the hand, come on this way. And then verses 3 and 4, we see that this mighty army that God is, let me say it this way. Later in this reading, we're going to see him calling the Medes, the Median nation. Medes and the Persians would be Iran, Iraq, that kind of that general area. I'm calling them to come take care of Babylon for me. And in fact, it was Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Great that took Babylon down. Okay, so they're coming from a far country. Yahweh and his instruments of indignation. Now, what do you see there in verse 5? Jumped out at me when I read through here. They are coming. Yahweh and his instruments. This is the coming of the Lord. This is the coming of the Lord. Right there in Old Testament, if you look at the prophets as being the not the dictionary, not the lexicon, the glossary. You look at the prophets of being the glossary of New Testament terms, here is the coming of the Lord. And what was it? It was an army being mustered to go in and conquer Babylon. But that's the coming of the Lord. Okay? Any thoughts on 1 through 5? All right, let's pick up then at verse 6. Wail, for the day of Yahweh is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of Yahweh is coming, cruel, with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation. And he will exterminate its sinners from it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. But I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than gold. I'm going to stop there. We'll pick up there in a minute. Just get this in front of us and talk about
No,
Yes. Yeah. Iniquity, transgression, wrongdoing. Basically all fit into that same category. But notice he says in verses 2 through 5, God is beckoning an army to come against Babylon. But verse 6 says the day of Yahweh is near. So this invasion of Babylon by an unnamed army at this point, we'll see later that it's called the Medes, but unnamed at this point, that invasion is called the day of the Lord. Now, in Joel 1 at verse 15, Joel is preparing his people for the coming invasion by Assyria. And he calls it the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord will come as destruction from the Almighty. So the day of the Lord, as it's used by the prophets, is a non-specific day. I mean, it could be, in this case, Babylon. In Joel's case, Samaria. In the New Testament, the day of the Lord was Jerusalem. It's a phrase that says this is when Yahweh stands up to punish and remove. Notice what it says: to remove, to make the land of desolation, to exterminate its sinners, and to where did I see it? To I didn't underline it. I thought I underlined it, but the idea of removing and purifying. Verse 9, to make the land a desolate, to exterminate sinners from it. Sure. Okay. The day of the Lord was a day of purification, a day in which the, how do I want to illustrate it? If you were a metallurgist or if you're a silversmith and you melted the silver down, and there's some, what do they call it, something that floats to the top? Dross, yeah, or flux, the throwaway part. The heat gets rid of the throwaway part, and so the day of the Lord was a day of punishment to remove sinners, to get them out of the way. That's the thing that carries through. You'll see it in Malachi, you see it again then in First Peter and Second Peter, that we're going to purify God's people through a time of a severe, calls it, what do you call it? In 1 Peter 4, about verse 12. I can't remember the terminal. I remember the place, but I don't remember the terminology. He calls it a okay, right here, fiery ordeal. The fiery ordeal, which is among you. In chapter one, he says that the purging of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire. Faith tested by fire. And so the day of the Lord was to remove sinners, but also to purify. Think about it, Alan. God comes through and he is removing sinners from the land, and it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to go through that. And so you will, of necessity, get rid of the things in your life that don't need to be there. See, and so it has the removing of the dross even from the individual. I'm plowing deeper than I want to on this. And so we have the coming of this unnamed or yet to be named Medo-Persian army at Yahweh's behest. It's his day of reckoning, and the people will be terrified. They'll be overtaken by pains and anguish. They'll writhe like a woman in labor, and they'll look in the startle. What's happening? They can't figure out why society has gone belly up like this. I look at the chaos in our streets and people trying to blame this guy or that guy or that policy or this other policy. And the reality is, further we get from following God, the more trouble we're going to have in society, and not understand why bad stuff is happening. It must be the Christian's fault. Now look at verse 10. Here we know what we're dealing with. We know we're dealing with the invading of the Medo-Persian army, and it's the day of the Lord, his consecrated army of ruthless people coming in to do what they're going to do. And it says, the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. An invading army can cause that to happen, put the sun out. But you say, huh?
Well,
Okay, so we could be looking at particulates in the air, both from the burning down of the cities, as well as the rushing of the horses and the streets weren't paved with asphalt like ours are. They're just dust. Yeah, and so we could see that. But there's also a metaphorical sense in which I mean, you go back to what was it, 1929, when the stock market fell. What do they call that Friday? Why do they call it Black Friday? The sun was shining. It was a dark day, metaphorically, emotionally dark. It's like well, that's the night the lights went out in Georgia. That's the night they hung an innocent man. That we use, I guess what I'm trying to say is we use that concept of this is really dark stuff in bright sunlight because of the pall that it puts on our future. Okay?
Lost their home and everything.
They lost everything. Was a dark day. Yeah. And so I'm saying all that because then when we come over to the New Testament, say in Matthew 24, where Jesus talks about the sun going dark, he was talking about when they tore the temple in Jerusalem down in AD 70. And so rather than looking for some meteoric, atmospheric phenomenon, just understand that he's talking about how emotionally how the lights went out for that nation that day. I remember years ago, about the time I was starting into college, Boeing was having a lot of trouble, and somebody posted on a sign somewhere, "Would the last person out of Seattle please turn out the lights?" Okay, we get the concept. Okay, and verse 11: Thus I will punish the world for its evil. This is what I'm going to do. This is how I punish the world for its evil. I'm going to take away everything that they were having a luxurious life in, and just terrify them. I'll put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness. I mean, it's kind of hard to be haughty when your whole world is collapsing around you, and that world that you built on your arrogance and your pride, and it's all collapsing around you. All right. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, verse 13, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of Yahweh of hosts in the day of his burning anger. I want you to see the idea of the shaking of heaven and earth there. And over in Hebrews chapter 12, this idea is where does he say it? Oh, I'm looking at 11. I wonder if I couldn't find it. In 12, he says, quoting from Haggai, verse 26, and his voice shook the earth then, that is at Mount Sinai. But now he has promised, this is from Haggai, now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. And this, yet once more, denotes the removing of things which can be shaken, as of created things, in order that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Created things, as opposed to not made with hands things. Frequently, we'll read in the prophets, and especially in the book of Hebrews, that things that were not made with hands, not like the temple or other things that were made, handmade, the things that God made, cannot be shaken, okay? That they might be remembered. You got this shaking here. When you read in the book of Hebrews, I want you to understand that this shaking then has to do with an invading army that's shaking things up. And sometimes earthquake is used that way, that we're just going to shake things up big time. All right, carrying on. And verse 14, and it will be that like a hunted gazelle or like sheep with none to gather, they will each turn to his own people and each one to his flee to his own land. What do you think that means? Especially focusing on sheep with none to gather.
You're just kind of
They're out doing their own sheep thing. They have no shepherd. Have no shepherd to call them to safety or to protect them or to lead them to pasture. They're just going to outdo their own thing.
mean like letting teenagers
Or letting a group of teenagers loose. I'm glad Candy's in this class because she brings some reality to it. Verse 15. Anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. So here, God's people, or not God's people, in this case, the people of Babylon, just scattered. Their leadership is gone. And if the Medo-Persians happen to find Alan, this Babylonian named Alan, hiding in a cave, what are they going to do to him? Off with his head. Yeah, just going to exterminate him. Anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Wow. The impact of the day of Yahweh on a society. Well, you can see why you call it a dark day. You can see why that phraseology could be applied there. It's not a pretty thing. And it happens because that's a pregnant pause. It happens because people have chosen to go their own way rather than to follow God. And anytime that happens, we deteriorate. A society that refuses to let God guide it naturally degenerates, naturally collapses under its own ugly weight. The overreach of a government that is impacted by liberal thinking is making it harder and harder to raise children with the fear and respect of God. I found out just the other day, I probably knew it, didn't realize I knew it. House sends homeschooling Timmy. But by the time he turns 8, he has to pass the state test to see whether they can continue to. Well, who gave them the authority to say whether or not you can teach your children the way you want to teach them? Anyway, the overreach of government is going to be, as Candy said, choking out the ability to install godliness in. So just, make it a focal point.
You can teach them how you want. They just gotta pass certain tests.
This is a future treatment target.
Yes. There's never gonna be anybody judging you unless they leave the home and they're so gone.
So here's this. I am calling, come on, guys, I'm calling my army to send against the Babylonians, and it's going to be ruthless. It's going to be savage. 15 and 16 really show the devastating nature of it, of what happens when a day of the Lord hits the society. If God decides to punish America, it ain't going to be pretty, and it ain't going to be easy, and it ain't going to be good. It will be good if it works the righteousness he seeks to work. And it will do that for people who want to follow him. It might be tough. Peter said in 1 Peter 4, if anyone suffers as a Christian, don't let him be ashamed. Let him in that name glorify God. Don't suffer as a murderer, an evildoer, or some other thing, some other bailout thing. But if you suffer as a Christian, be proud. Don't be ashamed. Stand tall. And so, fiery trial was coming for them. Well, they were in it. And so the fiery trial that may or may not, most likely will, come upon the United States is going to have to be met on our part with a determination to hold on to God. When you turn loose of your lifeline, what happens to you in a storm? You're washed out to sea or blown up, what, away. So you got to hold on. All right, enough about that. That's all about I'm calling my forces. Now in verse 17, he names them. Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them. How does God do that? How does God stir up anybody? I'm going to stir up the Medes against them. It's not our province to try to answer how God does what he does. But it's not just random. Okay, in the first chapter of Ezra, God stirred the heart of Cyrus to give the edict to rebuild the temple. And I'm not sure of the process. All I know is God got it done. Here, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them. They won't value silver or take pleasure in gold, and bows will mow down young men. They will not have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, why did God overthrow Sodom and Gomorrah? They were corrupt. They were morally corrupt. They were in the sexual realm. That's the one we really know about. They were debased. But almost always, when those two are together, they are corrupt judicially, because they're being ruled by greed rather than by love. And so it'll show up in a variety of ways. And so, just like I overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, I'm going to overthrow the Chaldeans using the Medes. Verse 20, it will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch their tent there, nor will shepherds make lie down there, but desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches also will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her time also will soon come. and her days will not be prolonged. Now, I'm not sure who the who, her is there, whether he's saying that this is about to happen to Babylon, or whether he's saying the Medes that I'm calling, that their day will not be long either. I suspect he's talking about Babylon never being inhabited. Now, look at verse 20 and 21. That paper that I'm supposed to be four pages, two sheets, about Babylon in prophecy and history. Years ago, maybe, I don't know, Glenn, you might be able to remember, but it's got to be at least 50 years ago. I wrote a pamphlet called Cities of Prophecy, in which I looked at various cities, Tyre and Petra and Babylon and Jerusalem, that were prophesied against. The argument that we're going to build as we go through Isaiah, getting into chapter 40 through 44 especially, the argument we're going to build is that you can know that these idols are not gods, because nothing they ever, they can't tell you what's going to happen. They're unable to tell you what's going to happen. But I can. They challenge the idols to say, tell us what's going to happen. First of all, he says, tell us what you told in the past that was going to happen that had fulfillment. Or tell us, and then he says to his people, you're my witnesses that I told you things like that, and they've come to pass. The fact that you're in captivity is one of them. But I'm also, I'll tell you what's going to happen. See if they can do that. He says, that's when he called Cyrus by name. 200 years before laying the foundation of the temple, he says Cyrus would do it. 150 years before he's born, Cyrus would do it. Now, the point I'm trying to get at is this booklet I wrote took those prophecies and showed a fulfillment that came sometimes 500 or 600 years later. And so how did the prophet know? Well, he couldn't know unless God told him. And that was the point. Okay,
Ron,
so that paid. Yes, Glenn.
A little sideline for you. I just gave a copy of that pamphlet to my grandson.
Is that right? Tammy's or Jaron's or?
It was Tammy's oldest.
Whose?
Tammy's oldest son.
Tammy's oldest, okay. Well, you go. Yeah, and so I know that Glenn used to use that when he was an educator in the Michigan collegiate system, and he was teaching sciences, sometimes evolution, and he used that booklet because of the not because of the, it was so well written. I sometimes wince when I read it again, but because of the power of the predictions, that nobody could know these things, and yet they were spot on. The one about Tyre was amazing. But anyway, that's what that page is. It's an excerpt from that booklet, that pamphlet. And it's some amazing stuff in verse 20. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. Now, current Baghdad is close to where ancient Babylon was, but nobody lives in ancient Babylon. And won't. And the shepherds won't lie down. There was a superstition that scared them. And all it's going to be is wild animals. There's a museum in Chicago, in University of Chicago, Orient Institute has a museum, and it's stuff, Bible Day stuff. Starts with either you go in, it's Egypt, and then works way through Akkadia, Babylon, Assyria, Babylon, and on into Judea. And one of the things in there, you ever heard of the Ishtar Gate? Ishtar Gate? It was a magnificent gateway into the city of Babylon. And it was lined with azure blue, cobalt blue tiles. And it was replicated in this museum with tiles that were taken from the spot. And it's beautiful, just gorgeous. And one of the seven wonders of the ancient world were the Hanging Gardens of Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. And he says it's just going to be desert creatures there. It's just, it would be like us trying to imagine what it would be like if New York City just became a wilderness refuge in a garbage dump. So it boggles the mind. But God says that's what's it going to be for Babylon. And the reality is that's the way it is still today. It's still today. You can read, there's other, Jeremiah has some things to say about it in other places, but this threat that was going to take them into captivity was going to end up like this. Okay? Now, chapter 14 is a fascinating chapter because of the some of the wild ways that it's used. All right, verse 1. When Yahweh will have compassion on Jacob. Now, I'm going to stop here and preface these remarks by, we will find through Isaiah, we have already found through Isaiah talking about current things and what's happening right now. And then, but it'll come about in the last days. Remember chapter 4, that there's nothing current about chapter 4. It's all about God rescuing his remnant and finding those whose names were written in the book of life and tabernacling with them. Way off down in the future. And so sometimes we'll be right there in the current. And then, boom, looking at things that are going to come under Messiah. How do I want to say this? In Galatians 4, we read of the allegory of Hagar and Sarah, how that they represented the slave wife and the free wife, and these free children, children of promise, and natural children who were in slavery, how that was an illustration of what God would do with Christians and Jews at the time of Christ. Some were going to inherit because they were children of promise, and some would be cut off and sent away and have nothing because they were. The point I'm making is that the history of Israel became an illustration of almost a prophecy of what God was going to do. Shadows, types, parables, allegories, these are all used in the New Testament to talk about what was happening in the days of Jesus based upon what had happened. The law was a pattern. It was a parable of things to come. Hagar was an allegory. See, and so when we talk about the fall of Babylon, is it the fall of Babylon or is it the fall of Babylon? You know, in the book of Revelation, Babylon the Great has fallen. Well, Babylon the Great in the book of Revelation is the city of Jerusalem. Okay, so is it allegorical or is it actual? I think these four verses here, three verses, are allegorical. Are looking with the fall of Babylon, we've got the release of God's people. And that theme is echoed throughout the book of Revelation. Come out of her, my people. Okay. Then when Yahweh will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them on their own land, then strangers will join them, attach themselves to the house of Jacob, and the peoples will take them along and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of Yahweh as male servants and female servants. And they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. Now, just on a surface view of that, you see a reversal. we've been taken captive, but now we've taken our captives captive, our captors captive. We've reversed the role. We're no longer slaves, we're masters. We're no longer in bondage, we're free. But we looked at this word possess there in verse 2. House of Israel will possess. Now, we saw that earlier, probably back in chapter 4. But in Amos 9, Amos says that Israel will possess her neighbors. But James quoted that in Acts 15, and he says the Gentiles have a right to be converted to Jesus because Amos said all nations would call upon the name of the Lord. But he's quoting the Amos passage where take them into possession. So we're going to have them as our family is really what the concept is. Okay? So this, another way of saying it, this, what we read here, these first three verses, is like the promise that was made to Solomon, or to David, that his offspring would build a temple for him. Solomon did, but so did Jesus. Now, which one was he talking about? Both. Both. The one was the illustration of the one to come. And so, also, when Babylon was subdued, God's people got to go home. I mean, that's what Cyrus did, sent them home almost immediately after Babylon was subdued. But that was just typical of what was going to happen when the real Babylon, the spiritual Babylon, i.e. Old Testament, Old Covenant Israel at the time, when they were conquered, then God's people would go home and be on the land. Okay, verse 4, and it will be, verse 3, it will be in that day, it will be in the day when Yahweh gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you have been a slave, that you will take up a taunt against whom? The king of Babylon. You're going to take up a taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased. Fury has ceased. Now, I want to stop here and remind you about the axe in chapter 10. The axe in the hand of Yahweh was, pardon? Yeah, Assyria. Yeah. He's using Assyria to cut down his forest. Okay. Here, and where it went in chapter 10 was, you are going to rejoice when I turn and destroy Assyria. Okay. So here it's going to happen to the king of Babylon as well. Verse 5, Yahweh has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers. How many kings did Babylon have? Well, at least 4, maybe 5, 70 years.
Oh.
Nebuchadnezzar didn't last the entire 70 years. And the guy that saw the handwriting on the wall right there at the end was his grandson, okay, or his great-grandson, okay. So against the king of Babylon, but then you see in verse 5, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued nations in anger with unrestrained persecution, the whole earth is at rest. The Yahweh has sent the Medes against the Babylonians. Now the whole earth is at rest, is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you, the cedars of Lebanon. Since you were laid low, no cutter comes up against us. That's a clear reference back to chapter 10, isn't it? Assyria started the cutting, Babylon continued the cutting, but now Medo-Persia, their policies were different. They were peaceful. They repatriated. Sent the captives back to their fatherland to figure they would prosper better there and there'd be, you know, everything would be even better if people were back on their natural homeland. And that was the policy of the Medo-Persians. And so verse 9, Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. Oh boy, here's another one. The king of Babylon. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. They all will respond and say to you, even you have been made weak as we. Now, these various kings that were in Sheol, wherever that is, we'll talk about that in a minute. How'd they get there? Probably from him. And then, okay, they're all down there because of where there is, because of him. And then they see him come and say, you're just like one of us. You know better. I mean, you arrogant guy, you're just like one of us. Now watch this. Verse 11, your pomp, the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Did you know that the music can go to Sheol? If we think that he's talking about hell, he's not. Hades. What is Sheol? No. Yes, no. It means unseen. You can't see it anymore. You know? Pick a nation that used to be a nation when you were a kid, and you look at the map and say it's not there anymore. Where is that nation? It's in Sheol. It can't be seen, can't be found. It's gone. It means very little more than that, though you can see the fact that we're gone might have varying implications, but the music is gone. That's all he's saying. The music of the harp is in Sheol. It's gone. It's been taken away from you. If the music of your the music of the gaiety of your living has been taken away from you, what does that mean about you? You're in a period of devastation, gloom, darkness. Okay, just interesting ways of phrasing a thing. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out beneath you, and worms are your covering. Well, here you got the idea of a guy rotting in the grave, don't you? The worm's crawling. Okay, a guy rotting in the grave. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, O son of the dawn. How? Now, who are we talking about? Verse 4. Who are we talking about? The king of Babylon. Okay? But here he's called Star of the Morning. You want to guess how some translations have that?
Lucifer.
You know what Lucifer is? The word Lucifer means light bearer. You see a pheromone, born on the wind. Pharaoh is a Greek word which means to carry. Lusa is light, carrier of light. All right? Lucifer, oh, son of the morning, star of the morning, son of the dawn, you have been cut down to earth. This is not talking about the fall of Satan. It has nothing to do with Satan. It's talking about the fall of the king of Babylon, the arrogance of the man. You said in your heart, I'll ascend to heaven. I'll raise my throne above the stars of God. I'll sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. Now, put yourself in the populous place where that king is coming to invade your territory, and he has this arrogant attitude. And who's been able to stop him? Nobody up to this point. And so he's got this braggadocious attitude about himself, and you are trembling at his presence because he has this, I will be like God, and who's going to stop me? I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will make myself like the Most High. Okay, that was what he thought. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol. Nobody's going to see you anymore. To the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you. Is this the man? Is this the man? You see that? Can't be talking about Satan. Is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness, i.e. an axe cutting things down, overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? Now, the entire Assyrian captivity did not allow their prisoners to go home. And Babylon just took over with the same policy. But when the Medo-Persians took over, they started repatriating, let their prisoners go home. So this is very short term, very temporal in nature, and is about to change with the onset of the Medo-Persians. He says, all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like trampled corpse. Now, all I want to say about this is you're living through this, right? Put yourself back at this period of time. And you got this arrogant king, this nobody could stand against him. And you just live in fear. And you read something like this. You are going to be, you're not even going to be in a grave. You're going to be cast out of your grave. You're a rejected branch. It gives you some hope. You will, verse 20, not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. Now, I'm not going into the politics of this. Just an illustration that just happened. That guy that was ruling Venezuela, Maruda, was that his name? What was it like in the streets of, what do they call it, little Venezuela down in Florida? What was it like in the streets of the Venezuelans that had been had fled the country? What was it like when he was taken captive? Rejoicing in the streets. Now, you, of course, got the political pushback on that. That's not the point. That man was ruining his country. And it was a rejoicing when he was removed. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter. Because of the iniquities of their father, they must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. Now, his sons, not talking about Satan's sons, is it? Talking about the king of Babylon and who might continue the rule. We can't let that happen. We've got to put an end to that. And I will rise up against them, declares Yahweh of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares Yahweh. I will also make it a possession of for the hedgehog and swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares Yahweh of hosts. I find that phrase fascinating. I will sweep it with the broom of destruction. Now, what, Candy, you work in a situation where you might ever once in a while have to use a broom or have somebody use one. What's the purpose of a broom? To clean up. Yeah. Well, I'm not talking about hitting a wayward mate over the head with it, but it, you know, I'm going to sweep. The idea is to get rid of the debris using destruction. Destruction was going to sweep and thus clean up the place, get rid of the debris, get rid of the garbage. So let's see if we can really quickly, we're not going to finish the chapter, but I wanted to finish down through 26. Yahweh of hosts has sworn, saying, surely just as I have intended, so it has happened, and just as I have planned, so it will stand. Up to this point, things have happened the way I said they would, and going forward, they're going to happen the way I said they will. Now, this is the argument that is in chapter 40 to 44. I mentioned that already. But here you have, it's kind of like the seed of the argument planted right here. The overthrowing of the nations, and therefore the overthrowing of the nation's gods, pick that thought up in chapter 40 especially, is something God predicted. Yahweh predicted this. And he continues to predict. And therefore, people who see the prediction and see the fulfillment can say, he alone is God. He is the only source of salvation that I have. And that's what he's saying here. I have sworn, it will, as I have intended, it has happened. And just as I have planned, it will stand. to break Assyria. Now look at there. We've been talking about the fall, downfall of what? Babylon. To break Assyria in my land, and I will trample him on my mountains. Then his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. This is one of the passages that caused me to believe that the Assyrian Babylonian invasion was one unit of thought, two different nations carrying it out. But it was God's people, part A, and God's people, part B, that were taken away, right? And so here, as we're talking about the overthrow of Babylon, the overthrow of the king of Babylon, he comes and mentions, I'm going to break Assyria. Well, Assyria was the cutter in chapter 10, but Babylon was the cutter in chapter 14. So I see them blending together like that. You make up your own mind on that, but that's something that works for me, just to see that event in history. It was a couple hundred years in duration, but it was seen as one purifying event for the people of God. Then his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations, for Yahweh of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? The Medo-Persian is going to do what I ordained them to do. They're going to get it done. Later in the book of Isaiah, I think it's chapter 45, into 44, Cyrus, my shepherd, will cause the temple's foundation to be rebuilt. I've got a plan, and Cyrus is going to carry it out. For Yahweh of hosts has planned, who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? Now, we're going to see that this stretched out next week. We're going to see that this stretched out hand, that we saw it back, what, in chapter 5, his hand is still stretched out. And some have thought that, here, come, let me rest you. But the idea of his hand is still stretched out. He's still punishing. See, and that's what he's doing here. Who can keep God from sending these nations into the plan? His hand is still stretched out. I would take that term to say Israel hasn't come to sufficient repentance for God to change the course yet. Now, next week, we're going to, starting here at the end of chapter 14, all the way up through chapter 23 is the impact of the dread of the nations because of the approach of Assyria and Babylon and God's advice to each nation. And it's really an amazing section. I'm eager to look at it with you, but that's what's going to be. What would God advise the various nations that, because when Assyria sweeps through, there's not just, it's a shotgun blast, it's not a laser point to get Jerusalem, it's just going to get everything. Well, what would you tell these people or these people or those people over there? What would you tell them in face of this coming invasion? I think you'll find it fascinating, but we'll reserve that for next week. Any thoughts? Okay, we'll turn the fire hose off and we'll just take a deep breath and relax. Remember to read 13 through 18 each week until we finish chapter 18. And then we'll read 19 through 24. 19, actually, it'll be 19 through 23, and you'll see why when I get there. But okay, that'll do it for tonight.